Knowledge Foundation, as your reporters showed, basically, that thousands of people were killed in these death traps. But there are other mechanisms that Israel is using, and now, you know, the reason they are removing this foundation and creating other mechanisms in the form of what's called green areas and red areas separated by the yellow line is another method of ethnic cleansing and genocide of the people of Gaza. So they experiment in different methodologies of destroying the people of Gaza, destroying the livelihood of Gaza. This is what they have been doing not even since October 2023, but since May 1948, when they experimented with how to remove Palestinian villages and towns, in some cases poisoning water wells, in other cases shelling them to oblivion, in other cases scaring them or raping women and committing massacres. So they tried different techniques, but the end result that they aim for is a Palestine without Palestinians and to rename it the Jewish State of Israel. That's the original plan and has not changed.
What about that, Mick, that basically experimenting and seeing different ways of being able to torture the Palestinians, according to our guests in Bethlehem? I mean, if we look at the Zionist entity and what it has done along with the U.S. government, would you say that the setup of this GHF not only should be, of course, blamed on the Zionists and the Americans, but the whole Western hegemonic front that allowed this entity to commit genocide and then allowed the same entity to decide who can actually distribute aid to the people that they are targeting and killing every day?
You've set us up in this program for a very difficult task, and it's to find a language to describe the horror, the depravity and the barbarism of what's being visited upon the people of Palestine. And as our other guest points out, this goes back a very, very long way. But let's try. I think that in science and in politics and in any other area of life, if you have a simple theory that explains everything, then we should use that theory. And Israel wants to kill Palestinians. Israel, I mean, Ariel Sharon was quoted by another cabinet minister as saying in a cabinet meeting that the only good Arab was a dead Arab. And that's what he said, and that's what he meant. And that was his whole history. His whole record was based on that idea. And the whole Zionist project is based on that. They would much prefer, like a Pied Piper, for the Palestinians to follow a Piper and leave Palestine. But in reality, they know they have to use overwhelming violence and full-spectrum criminality in order to achieve their goal. Their goal is, as they say to the world, to remove Palestinians from Gaza. And Donald Trump joins in to turn it into a real estate deal. But, you know, it's absolutely bestial. There is experimentation because the Zionists are strategic. The present crop of mass killers are different from earlier crops. I mean, we saw, for example, in the Great March of Return a few years ago, thousands of Palestinians maimed, industrial numbers injured and crippled, and hundreds, thousands killed over the course of that experiment by the Palestinians in peaceful demonstration and an experiment by the Zionists in industrial-scale killing in the full view of the world. And I think we have to go back to that to say, when the Israelis found out that they could do that, that they could openly in their press boast about snipers killing and maiming Palestinians, when one of them could boast in the media that he, in one shift, shattered 43 Palestinian knees with his sniper rifle. When they saw that they could get away with that, then they decided to escalate.
Okay.
Because, and that's what we are seeing. We are seeing diabolical killing, full spectrum killing. And the key thing is, as you've alluded to, the Western chancelleries have not been critical. They've been silent. They have continued to send weapons. But if you think that one of the elements of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation was actually, and I think if you wrote this into a novel, nobody would believe it, was a motorcycle gang, an anti-Islamic motorcycle gang with a history of provoking Muslims. But this bandit gang, this gang was hired by the Americans to man, to staff the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation.
Stay with me, Mick. Let me get Mazen back in on this. I mean, it's so dystopian, of course, when we think about everything that has taken place and continues to take place in Gaza. I mean, one of them is this, Mazen, your perspective, because the person that was hired to originally run this GHF was actually a former American sniper, an American sniper turned aid worker, and even he couldn't handle it more than 2 weeks. He said that it lacked basic humanitarian principles of neutrality. It is absolutely so mind-boggling when we just think about what is happening and continues to happen. I mean, your thoughts on this, Mazen?
Well, indeed, one of the people who worked for GHF eventually explained that these were the policies that were practiced. There was not about humanitarian aid. There was about control and starvation and killing, while projecting that the U.S. and Israel care about the Palestinian civilians in Gaza because they were afraid of sanctions and afraid of the growing boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. So, you know, this, as I said earlier, is a form of psychological warfare and propaganda. What the Israelis called Hasbara, you know, what the Americans call Hollywood productions of actions to produce a certain result that's desired in the mainstream media of Western countries. Of course, the people of Gaza don't buy it. People around the world didn't buy it, and there was a lot of talk about it. And I think eventually that's why they closed it and end up now trying new tools or new techniques.
Right, right. Well, Mick, since the GHF started its distribution, so-called distribution, in May of this year, 3,000 more Palestinians were killed at those so-called distribution centers. It is outrageous. It is unbelievable. I don't even know the words that we can use for this to even think that at a place that's supposed to be safe and distributing aid, that thousands and thousands of people were killed and thousands of others just simply humiliated and treated as if they were not human. Your thoughts about, first of all, how this was allowed, and two, that the world allowed it to happen. I mean, this is the reality. We know that there have been protests here and there and around the world, but at the bottom of the line, Palestinians are still starving to death as we speak.
I think genocides supervised by the Americans have been going on for a very, very long time. 3 million killed in Vietnam. And as a young man, I learned that they were openly scattering tiny little plastic, brightly colored little bombs across the land surface of Vietnam, specifically to be picked up by children and specifically to blow off parts of their limbs.
Right.
Not to kill them, but to overload the society, the health service, the social networks. And when I heard about this barbarism, which was not denied by anyone, was openly, not openly in the mass media on page one, but you could find it in scholarly journals. When I realized this was going on, I could never unlearn that. And you know, these genocides have been happening for a very, very long time. What's unique about the Gaza genocide, the Palestinian genocide, is that it does take place in the full glare of social media. That although Israel has killed, I'm sorry, I can't remember the number, is it 250 journalists during the last 2 years. They've killed so many journalists, but still other heroic figures are working as journalists in Palestine and Gaza today and telling that story. So it cannot be covered up. I mean, not one person in 100 knows about the Guatemala genocide, where America overthrew a democratically elected government, installed a monstrous regime which used germ warfare against their own native population. It was a genocide, and it's hardly known today. But people cannot ignore what's happening in Gaza, and they know it and they see it. And at the terrible cost that Gaza people have paid, Palestinians are paying, they have changed the consciousness of a huge chunk of the world to a degree that I find unprecedented, that this has burned deeply into people's awareness. And we see this in prime time social media. But our own governments are complicit, and they are not complicit in the sense that they are helping it. My own government is an active participant in it. So that the Royal Air Force flew over Gaza 500 times and gave intelligence to the killers on the ground. Mm-hmm. And then they admitted this in Parliament. So it's not that this is hidden. It's not that you can find out if you make an effort, which is the case with other genocides. It's that you cannot ignore it. And the full bestiality and barbarism of what's going on is really causing ripples around the world. In Britain, for example, the government has to arrest thousands of people who are protesting in support of the people of Palestine. Literally thousands are being arrested. I myself face 14 years imprisonment for solidarity activity. It's nothing, but it's nothing compared to what the Palestinians suffer. But our governments are forced into this repression. My daughter lives in Berlin. The police there are brutal. Anybody who appears in the street there with a keffiyeh or anything that signifies Palestine runs a serious risk. So it's public, it's well known, the governments know it, and they're using repression to try to sustain their support for the genocide.
Right. Well, Mazen, I mean, with the GHF, when Monday it announced that it's going to be suspending its operations, it also said that it's basically ready to expand its humanitarian actions dealing with the new creation of the Civil Military Coordination Center, a base now that has been set up in the occupied territories, seen as a transition with the U.S. military allegedly meant to oversee aid distribution and the so-called rebuilding of Gaza, part of that Trump plan. Your thoughts about this? I mean, we have seen, as I said, thousands of people were killed on their watch, and now they're saying we're suspending this, but we're waiting for basically bigger and better things to be able to help, so-called help the Palestinians in Gaza even more.
Well, what we are seeing is history repeats itself, as I said, once as a farce, once as tragedy, but history is repeating itself. You know, in 1920, the League of Nations gave a mandate to Palestine, to the British Empire, and now the United Nations has given a mandate to the American Empire for Palestine, for the West Bank, for the Gaza Strip, and the Gaza GHF basically was a test model for this mandate. They are refining it to implement basically an international U.S.-led oversight of the local people against the wishes of the local people. And of course, they don't want the local people to have any agency, and they want the local people to just do whatever they ask them to do, including disappear and die. Without any resistance. This is the plan, and this is the Trump plan, basically supported by Netanyahu, of course, and his government, this regime here, who could not win in Gaza, could not advance by military force. It could only, win the destruction of the people of Gaza and the landscape of Gaza, but could not win against the resistance. They want now Trump and the U.S. administration to achieve what they failed militarily to achieve it via what they will project as a political solution. They even call it a peace plan. I don't know where the peace comes from. Israel kills on average 2 children every day during the so-called ceasefire for almost a month now. So what you see on your screen is basically what needs to be done. Israel and the U.S. should be taken to international courts for violations of basic human rights, for war crimes, crimes against humanity. They should be subjected to sanctions, boycotts, divestments. That's the way we must go.
All right. Well, what about that, Mick? You heard what Tamazin said. Do you think that the responsible parties will be held responsible, will be held accountable? Because when we're looking at, of course, the Israeli entity and the Americans with the GHF in this, we also see the privatization and weaponization of aid in general. At the end of the day, are any of these entities going to be held responsible, your perspective?
You know, I like to think I can, in a shadowy way, see what the options are going forward. But on this one, I honestly don't know. The ICC in the past tried war criminals, but they were all black, apart from the Serbians, because any war criminals operating on behalf of the NATO powers were completely immune. Nobody dreamt of trying Kissinger, for example. So, but the case that the ICJ and the ICC has accepted against Israel and against Netanyahu, they accepted them because if they hadn't, the whole structure would have collapsed. It would have not just been very partisan and very unfair and only trying some war criminals and exempting others, which has always been the case, but it would have been seen around the world that genociders have nothing to fear from the ICJ or the ICC. So they had to initiate a process, and the South African government bravely stepped up there to the plate, and I think 14 other governments are supporting them. But where is the power? Where is the police that will enforce a judgment from the ICJ and the ICC? The only country in the world, as far as I know, found guilty by the ICJ for terrorism was the USA. They were actually found guilty when Nicaragua brought a case against them. But America just ignored it and continued to carry out remorseless massacres across the whole of Central America. So they didn't give a fig for that decision. So looking forward, your question is a fundamental question, but I cannot answer it. Nothing leads me to believe that these structures will actually enforce sanctions against the genociders, because they've never done so in the past. What they can do is, if they make a ruling, they can stimulate civil society to take action. We saw the Docker strikes and the riots and demonstrations in Italy recently in support of the Palestinian people and against their regime, which is very pro-Israel. We see in some places in America, we see dock workers for many years have refused to unload any Israeli ships. So we see the possibility of defeating them, but that defeat will not come from these official structures. It will not come from our governments who are complicit, who are making money, who completely agree with the genocide. Why would America not support Israeli genocide? America's born from genocide. Smallpox blankets, extermination of the native people. It's natural for the elites there to have sympathy with their latter-day acolytes. So I don't think any hope can come from there, but hope can come when people begin to speak Italian in the sense of the recent riots and strikes, and that can defeat Israel and will defeat Israel.
All right, and on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. Mazen Qomsai, a university professor, historian, and author out of Bethlehem. Mick Napier, co-founder of Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Glasgow. And thank you for being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزای لازمی است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن، دوری از قرآن، از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
کتاب الله.
Start. Movement. Speed. Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamidi.
Islamidi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. السلام علیکم to all of you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Youth Station. This is Nahid having the honor of being with you, and here with me I have the pleasure of being with my very dear sister
Masuma. How are you?
Great. How about you?
Everything is nice. I have been in some societies that they pray a lot, and it's very nice. They pray to God, but they don't take any important step for it. For example, regarding marriage, they're like, you should pray for a very, you know, happy marriage. And then I understand, yes, you have to, because a big part of it is not in your hand, but that does not mean that you should not take any step.
Right.
And in some other cultures I have seen, that they sometimes forget praying at all. They think all the burden of big responsibilities and successes is on their own little shoulders. And they forget that they can pray. They can do their own effort and then leave the rest on God.
You mean there is no balance? Some cultures are just surrounding themselves with dua and prayer.
Yes.
While others are rejecting this role and are just going alone.
Rejecting, forgetting, I would say, because they are God believers. They are Muslims. They're very nice. But sometimes they forget that, dear brother and sister, you're not alone on this earth.
Yeah, they feel like they're left.
Yeah, that they have to do everything on their own. And it's really interesting how different people make different du'as. Some are always scared, making dua of, oh God, please protect me, please protect me, please protect me. Some other are very optimistic, and they're, God, I know you're going to bless me. I know you're going to bless me. And it's very interesting how different people talk different to God. And if we ever have time to check how scholars, people who are close to us because they have lived, you know, around our eras, when we read their duas, how they talk to God, it's amazing. It's beautiful.
Yeah, now that you were mentioning, I remembered some friends of mine, they're Arabs, and seeing the difference in culture, like they are believers of Allah, and the way they call him, the way they call Allah, the way they call their own creator, now those literally words that they use, like, I don't know, the light of my eye.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, the beauty of my soul. The way they call their creator is really fascinating to me. I mean, in our cultures, we do have it the same way. We have poets and we have prose writers who use wonderful phrases. But since we got used to our own culture, our own literature, sometimes we're not aware that our culture is talking to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in this way. But once we see the other cultures and we start comparing, we see, wow, how beautifully people are calling him.
And when we are encountering all these differences, I think the best way to learn, the best method of talking to God would be how our imams, the infallible imams, made their du'as and prayers. Because they were the best. And Allah has given us them as role models. Right. They're our role models and we need to follow. And alhamdulillah, we have Sahifiyya Sajjadiyya, how to talk to God. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's such a piece of soul.
Yeah, exactly. And also, the other thing is that when I think of praying and the role of praying in different cultures, in our own culture, I come to this question that why do people turn to prayer? I mean, the very first basic question. We're Muslims, we know that we have Allah available. We have him next to us. We have him close to our heart. But what is the reason that some countries are overdoing it? And some other ones are not. Like you mentioned, you perfectly mentioned that some countries forget.
Yes.
And they feel like they have everything. The burden is on their own shoulder and they have to bear it. But why do we start praying from the very first notion of praying and doing du'as?
I think it's because we know how helpless we can be and how amazing life could be. So that's when we need a bigger hand to protect us.
Right.
Something bigger to help us get through this life. For example, I want that goal, which is very possible. It is possible, but yet we know that there can be problems that I don't see yet. There can be flaws that I have but I don't know yet. So when I find myself helpless, this is how I think Allah has created us to go back to him and talk to him. This is
so
in our
true.
Nature. I believe this is in our nature. To seek help, but not from people. To seek help from God. From that one that knows and has the power.
So beautiful. And this is the role of prayer. Like, as for me, I can say that prayer reconnects me to meaning and comfort.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the meaning that I cannot see. That perception that I can't find it on myself. If I even overthink and do lots of things to try to solve a problem, I cannot find that pleasure that I find once I start talking to him, once I tell him about the problem, once I ask him for help. This is the place where I can find the meaning of the problem, the meaning of life, the meaning of myself as the creation of Allah. And the other thing is this comfort. I mean, there we feel safe.
Yes.
We feel private. We feel that no one is going to interrupt us, no one is going to hurt us, and no information is going to be spread. So this is the comfort zone for us. This is the place where we feel that everything is okay for you.
And how beautiful it is that we are allowed to make dua and talk to God whenever, wherever. Have you ever heard God telling you, oh, do not talk to me, for example, at that time, or don't talk to me when you are sinful? The opposite, we see he calls his people, come. He welcomes us however we are. And, you know, it reminds me of one verse in the Quran, Surah Ghafir, verse 60, where he clearly says, call upon me, I will respond to you. He will respond to us, and that's such a comfort. Like, girl, God is listening.
Knowing that He is there, He's not going to just postpone you or not answer you or answer you in a way that you don't deserve. Like, many of our friends, maybe they're so busy.
Yes.
We message them, we tell them the problem, and they are just, like, answering us so that they have answered. But when it comes to Allah, we know that the response that we're going to receive is the true essence of meaning and the thing that we need.
It is the best response that we can ever get.
So true. And also in Sahifa Sajjadi, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam had said, God loves the voice of His servants calling Him. He loves the way we're talking to Him. And even He says, if you have done 100 sins, come back to Me. Come back to Me, even if you are that criminal, I don't know, that wrongdoer.
Yes.
Still, I'm waiting for you with open arms. So this is the beauty of just reciting dua and just praying for Him.
And it never gets boring, because if you're a child, you're asking for a candy. If you're older, you're asking for something even bigger. And if your soul has grown enough, you're asking for those stages of heaven that normal people cannot even think of. And it's something that you can always use.
Yeah, so beautiful.
Never gets boring.
And now that we know that we have to do prayer for our own selves, let's go for a short break, and then let's name some different sources of prayer. If I'm a Muslim and I love to do du'as, I love to be connected to my Creator, what are the sources available that can help?
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back, and we're going to now name some different sources that can help us. What are the sources regarding the Islamic rich source of the du'as and prayers? One of them, as you mentioned, Sahifa Sajjadiya.
Yes.
This is the book in which our great Imam is teaching us even the phrases, even the words, even different ways and different places at which we can pray.
It's a ready-made template that we can go and reference to it. They're easy words. And they show you how creative, beautiful, and lovely you can talk to God. It's just interesting. You need to just go visit yourself to understand the beauty of it. We can have a whole separate topic about it. And other thing that I think is very useful is the Holy Quran, because it by itself has, Allah has taught us how to pray. Rabbi zidni ilma. It is telling us, oh God, increase my knowledge. God is telling me, what should I ask for? So sometimes we are like, okay, I am ready to ask God, but I don't know what to ask. This gate is open.
Or I don't know how to ask.
Yes. So everything is there. Beautiful. There are so many du'as inside there. There are also some du'as that Allah in the Quran is telling us, how should we pray for our parents? رَبِّ ارْحَمْهُمَا كَمَا رَبِّيَانِي صَغِيرًا. These are so beautiful. Simple, easy, pinpointed.
Yeah, exactly. Also, Nahj al-Balagha, the great book of Imam Ali alayhi salam. There, Imam Ali is telling us about every perspective of life, the way he prayed, the way he the way he lived his own life. And there we can get lessons that we can never find. We can never find on ourselves. We can see experiences that they could have not come to us normally. So regarding the Islamic context, we have the Holy Book of Quran. We have Sahifa Sajjadiya. We have Nahj al-Balagha. Also, our du'as. I mean, we have du'a kumail, the kind of du'a that is prepared for us, that in which we supplicate and we pray to Allah. And the beautiful phrases mentioned. There we have the quotes. We have the ways to call Him and ask Him for advice and help.
It can really give us the great meaning of worshiping.
Exactly. And regarding the role of du'a and prayer, now that we know the source, we know that we need them, what is the emotional role of du'a? I mean, have you experienced this? This happens to me, that I felt it's the end of the world.
Yes.
I felt it's the worst thing that could have ever happened to
me. It's breaking me.
Yeah. And then I pray. I do my even normal prayer. And then at the end, I talk to Allah.
Yes.
I tell Him about this. Lovely. And I kind of free myself of all those negative energy. And then I feel it wasn't that bad.
Yes. You know what? We have tawakkul in Islam.
It's like we are recharged.
Mm-hmm. You know, because we have tawakkul in Islam, this is, you know, the other face of it, if I would like to rephrase it in my own little words. When I pray, I know that, okay, now I clearly mentioned my problem to God. He is there. Now I am leaving the part that is not in my hand in His hand. So this tawakkul, oh beautiful God, such a relief. And you know, these all sounds words until you face a problem where you're helpless and you can't do much. And all you can do is, you know, trust Allah. And once you experience it, you're going to understand. And if you have experienced, you can totally relate with me how lovely it is, that sense of relief.
And also Islam makes this connection more beautiful by asking us to pray for others as well.
Beautiful.
I mean, we are supposed to.
Yes.
Be brothers and sisters, be next to each other, know about our even neighbors, and then pray for them. Even the role models of Islam would have gone for the prayer for other people first, then for themselves.
Like how Lady Fatima said, Ajar thumma dar, first pray for others.
Exactly. And this is the lesson of Islam. Islam is teaching us even the process. The correct process is that we have to be aware of our friends, of our brothers, our sisters, and even pray for them. And even in Islam, we have this tradition that if we pray for each other, the effect will be even blessed.
Yes.
The effect will be more.
Yeah, you know, that we have heard that pray from a tongue that you have not committed any sin, which means pray for each other. I shall pray for you and you shall pray for me.
Yeah, exactly. And even in our recitations, in our du'a and phrases of the prayer, we pray for our imams and prophet as well. See,
how lovely.
We are having this family of Islam. This ritual is teaching us that we have to be aware of even our basis to the end.
And if Allah has not told us, guided us, we would never, you know, dare to pray for them. We would be like, oh my God, who am I? Who am I to pray for these infallible imam? What am I? But then God is giving us this sense of being. You can and you may pray for others, for even imam.
Yeah, and this is probably the answer to the thing that we started today's episode with. Why are different cultures having their own way, having their own language, their own traditions of praying and doing dua? So it's nice that every culture has unique spiritual expressions.
Or not nice in some situations.
Yeah, for sure.
We have experienced those not nice. If you are by any chance in some sort of society or surrounded with people that are giving you a bit, I don't want to say toxic, but, you know, not what Allah has asked us, you don't have to wait for them to change. You can be the change. So make prayer, but that does not mean that you should not take any step, and you're not alone.
Well, that was all for today's episode. Until the next time we meet, we wish you great pray. Remember us in your prayer as well. Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about this.
We'll discuss that, inshallah, in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
To happen to me, this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. I wish that somehow you tell me out. Oh, on that day Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong. I know I'm waiting, yearning for something, something known. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong.
The slogans in the placards are a protest to the law and the U.S. government's indifference towards the demands of the American women during the 60s and 70s. Indifference towards women's rights to education, equal pay, suitable jobs, respect and social rights. And most of all, protection against domestic violence. Of course, perhaps these women's anger was more towards the laws that did not have their back rather than their husbands. Women who were beaten at home by their husbands for different reasons, yet the law only supported them up until the door of their house. The law's excuse for this was not to intervene in the citizens' private affairs. Thus, when it came to the house, it was the men who made the law. The battered women would cover up their bruised faces with makeup, and there weren't many who were much inclined to speak about the things that happened to them inside the house.
Okay, let's go.
The men, on the other hand, did not shy away from violence towards their wives due to the free pass the culture and law gave them in this regard. The women of America demanded rights to education, payment, and security.
Equal rights to set forth our own humanity, equal rights to get into graduate programs, to get into schools, to training programs. We're the bottom third of the employment in terms of pay. We represent nonetheless 34% of the workforce, yet we're the first to be laid off and the last to be hired. There aren't frivolous demands at all. We just want what men have had all these years.
This issue did not belong to past centuries. This is the United States of America of 1970. Although protests against domestic violence intensified during the second half of 1970, husbands abusing their wives and justifying their actions had roots in times as far as the first American immigrants who settled in those lands. When the first immigrants arrived in this region, they started to write laws for their newly founded America by forming a government. The first settlers of America took their law from the common law derived from the traditional rules of the British judicial system. Common law originated in England in the Middle Ages and was applied in British colonies across the continents. According to this law, a man had the right to punish his wife if needed. In 1982, an important event took place that marked the beginning of a review in the issue of domestic violence against women. Tracy Thurman, a housewife in the city of Torrington. First, in October 1982, Charles, Thurman's husband, had a fight with her and threw her out of the house. Tracy went to the police department, but the police did not handle her case because there was no law to support her. A month later, it happened again. This time, Charles, Tracy's husband, broke the car window on her while she was sitting in the car. Tracy's body was covered with broken glass. This time, because the crime happened outside the house, the police got involved, and the court issued a restraining order against Charles for 2 years. However, during this period of 2 years, Charles repeatedly violated the court's order, and each time Tracy's complaint did not result in anything. Charles even threatened to kill her once, but the police did not do anything about it. A few months later, when Tracy was at home with her child, her husband Charles entered their residence. Tracy called the police. Charles stabbed Tracy's neck, throat, and chest with a knife. At this moment, a police officer arrived, but Charles, without fear, kicked Tracy in the head with another hard blow. Tracy was now lying on the ground in her own blood, but the police still did not react. Charles was about to attack Tracy, who was sleeping on the stretcher of the emergency team. But this time, the police stopped watching and finally arrested Charles after he had inflicted multiple stabbings and hittings to Tracy's head several times. Tracy Thurman spent 8 months in the hospital. Some of her body parts were temporarily and others permanently paralyzed. This time, instead of suing her husband, Tracy sued the police department for not supporting and defending her. Now, women's slogans had become more uniform and coherent. Women unite. Don't let racism divide us. Girls are powerful. The rise of women's protests against men's violence, along with the liberal slogans, marked yet another event. Feminist movements were gradually born, and protests against the inferior status of women and the violence they endured at home began in the American society. American states, one by one, began to repeal the laws that allowed men to punish women.
What does International Women's Year mean to you?
I'm afraid not very much, really. I'm a bit old to be worried, you know.
Do you ever think about women's liberation?
I don't, to tell you the honest truth, no.
I think possibly I'm like a lot of women and depend a lot on a husband, you know? On the male race, I guess.
The U.S. government, maintaining that a man's home is his castle, had traditionally been reluctant to police the confines of the home. Moreover, many legal authorities insisted on blaming the victim and believed that the wife was partially responsible for her beating by provoking her husband and making him angry. American laws allowed a man to punish a woman under the pretext of reforming her. The courts only considered the complaint of a beaten woman if the woman was severely injured during the beating by her husband.
This is the police.
Okay, what I want is a battered woman.
You are a battered woman?
Yes.
Who assaulted you?
My ex. He's in the house and I'm scared.
Is he in the house?
Yes, and I'm scared.
It's a frying pan that he threw at me, and I'll show you the nightgown that I have that's got full of blood on.
David, you're under arrest for domestic violence.
However, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was approved by the United Nations General Assembly in Paris on December 10, 1948, said something else. Article 1 of the Declaration. All human beings are born free and are equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood.
Approved by an overwhelming majority. The Declaration of Human Rights as a standard of conduct for all. And let us, as members of the United Nations, conscious of our own shortcomings and imperfections, join our effort in good faith to live up to this high standard.
But women were still deprived of such a right in America. Violence against women was considered normal. This normality can be understood in a joke that was broadcast on the BBC radio in the same years. A woman asks another why she feels her husband doesn't love her anymore. She hears the answer, he hasn't beaten me in a week or two.
How many domestic violence calls do you get on most nights?
Might not be unusual to have 6 or 8. Is this the first time this has happened?
He got pissed off at me and said I was attacking him, and then he started hitting me.
Little by little, various organizations started to deal with the domestic violence against women under the title of non-governmental organizations. The law changed, but the culture of violence against women still carries on. The slogan of gender equality gradually made women own rights that might have been funny to think about in the United States a few decades ago. In addition to the right to vote and the right to employment and equal wages, they now had the right to wear clothes. They could decide for the life or death of the fetus inside their womb, or they could even have other kinds of freedom in sexual issues. But did helpless women really join feminism movements to achieve such freedoms? Apparently, everything has benefited women. But there is still a problem. Women were still beaten by men. Liberalism. It reinforced racism, classism, and other forms of oppression. Women were now oppressed again. But this time, this oppression was not only from their husbands. Every man who had the chance to communicate with that woman would provide the basis for this, with sexual harassment and physical violence. These are official statistics from within the United States. Every year, about 500,000 people in America are victims of sexual violence, including 12-year-old children. However, 90% of the people who were raped are adult women.
Stop domestic violence! Stop domestic violence!
Alicia is amazing.
amazing. She was my only sister, my younger sister. We were 5 years apart, but super close. She's my best friend growing up and into adulthood. She's the life of any party. She lit up any room she walked into. She had goals and dreams and aspirations that were taken from her at the young age of 20 years old. In a domestic violence situation, as we're here today to honor. She had been away from him about 3 or 4 months when she had restraining orders and PPOs when he tracked her down and took her life. We organized a domestic violence walk in honor of my sister and those who have suffered through domestic violence, are victims or who are survivors, who have gotten out. Anybody and everybody who has been in a domestic violence situation, we're out here today to honor them and hopefully spread awareness that, you know, you're not alone and there are resources out here.
She was amazing. Good kid.
She was all about her family, always with me or her sister or her niece, her dad.
Never got in trouble.
Never in trouble. She's just a good person. Yeah, great
very
heart.
Good girl. Would help anybody. She'd give the little shirt off her back.
The fact that it was pretty bad. It's sad. She's, you know, we miss her every day. You know, she was my baby niece, you know, so it's been pretty rough. Think about her constantly.
She's a beautiful person, so loving and friendly, and like she said, she's a life of the party. She's a great person.
It is that, you know, it's sad that we have to do this because, you know, they took my niece from us. You know, it's sad that this is the thing we have to do, but we're trying to get justice for her, and we want people to be aware of it, what's going on.
2022. According to statistics, one out of every three women in the United States has experienced violence from her husband or partner. About 20,000 calls are made to the domestic violence help centers every day. And on the other end of the line are people who have been beaten or threatened with death by their spouses or partners. The phenomenon of violence against women in the United States may not be at the top of the world news like that of third world countries. But this does not mean that violence against women does not exist in the States. According to statistics from the National Office on Domestic Violence, one woman is battered every 9 seconds in the United States. Florida State Senator Janet Cruz's report is worth considering.
In Florida, there were 106,000 reported domestic violence offenses in 2020, and that was including more than 200 domestic violence murders.
This log home at Big Lake was one of Bree Moore's favorite places.
Her formal name is Brianna, but as she got older, she wanted to be called Bree.
Her parents say they can still feel her presence here.
She would get me up early in the morning and say, "Dad, come on, we've got to go ride." She made every minute out of her life special.
Police told the Moores their daughter's body was found at her boyfriend's home, where he lived with his parents. The Moores asked if there had been a home invasion.
They said no. They said Josh, her boyfriend, killed her.
Bree would be the last. Years later, what really was happening with Josh and in his history, this was really the inevitable.
But at the time, Bree seemed so devoted to her boyfriend, busy at her job as an aide in a dentist's office. But behind her smile, Bree's co-worker saw signs of trouble, signs they didn't reveal to the Moores until after her death.
They told me that she had come in several times with black eyes, and one time she came in and she hadn't just been hit, they said she had been beaten. And she couldn't function. And she vomited in the sink, and she left after about 15 minutes they sent her home.
There were other red flags.
Well, I'll read you a text message that we found on Bree's phone after we got her phone back 2.5 years after she was killed. Bree texts, "You better love me and stop hitting me, please," with an exclamation point. "Josh, of course I love you. And Ramrod hit you, not I." So Ramrod must have been, you know, when he got angry, I'm assuming.
Nadine M. Newfoyle, director of the Department of Violence Against Women at the U.S. Department of Justice, says, "Based on our findings in the United States, Every day, three women in this country are murdered by their spouse or ex-partner. This statistic is very alarming for us.